Hello, and thank you for joining us today on the Gentle Art of Crushing It show, where we focus on learning and sharing with our listeners all there is to know about how to create success in our lives. This show stands on the shoulders of giants. Our mission is to empower and inspire our listeners to create the life of their dreams whilst having a blast in the process. Let's celebrate life together. Welcome to the show.
Welcome back to the Gentle Art of Crushing It podcast. My name is Randy Smith, and I will be your host today. And I'm really excited to have a very interesting gentleman that I had the pleasure of meeting just a few weeks ago, Amit Ghaglani. Amit is the founder of AG Management Consulting Company. He's a passive investor, primarily in industrial flex, multifamily, self-storage, but he's also invested in ATM, natural gas, oil, Amazon stores, Shopify stores, and then you've got some history in physical therapy ownership. So, Amit, welcome to the show. I am so excited to have you here.
Thanks, Randy. Thanks for having me. Pleasure to meet everybody that's going to be listening.
Awesome. Well, why don't we just jump right in? Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you found yourself to be a passive investor?
Yeah. So we'll start with the physical therapy part of it, because that will lead into everything, because I'm a physical therapist, and I was a physical therapist business owner. And while I was going through that whole process of building my company out, I was wanting to invest in real estate, but I was too scared to actually buy something of my own. To be honest with you, I was worried that somebody's going to call me in the middle of the night and say, oh, the toilet's broken, come and fix it. And I was like, I don't got the bandwidth for that. You know, here I am, a busy guy trying to build my own practice, trying to do everything, working extra hours as it is. But I love the idea of investing in real estate. So I listened to podcasts, and then I heard about these things called syndications, which was like literally open the whole door for me. Now, this goes back, oh my God, how many years? 10, 15 years maybe? You know, and it was just starting up at the time, you know, syndications, and you had to figure out and do a lot of Google searching and understanding like what this is. But what I quickly understood is I could participate in real estate from a passive point of view, you know, back a good operator and sit back and actually get some returns for it. Now, are you getting all the returns that the syndicator is getting? No, but guess who's doing all the work? The syndicator, the guy who's the good operator, doing all the work, and you get to passively make money, which was beyond the money that I was making in a savings account. I wanted a diversification from the stock market, so it really gave me that opportunity. But Randy, here's the interesting part. While I was doing that, my friends who were high net worth individuals, they were physicians, surgeons, and whatnot, and some of them were business owners. They said they saw what I was doing, and they said, "That's interesting. Can we join you?" So I said, sure. You know, you do that a couple times, and before you know it, you have a couple million dollars that you're showing up to a syndicator saying, yeah, I see what you're advertising for everybody, but that's not good enough. If you want our money, you're going to have to give us better terms, better pref rates, better position on the waterfall, better tax mitigation. So I started negotiating. Now, this took about 8 years, but I kept doing this again and again and again. So it got us just better deals.
Are you interested in real estate investing but don't know where to get started or think you don't have the time or money? Are you stuck in your W-2 because the golden handcuffs make it hard to walk away? If this sounds like you, check out impactequity.net and schedule some time to talk with the founder, Randy Smith. Randy went from massive income to leaving his W-2 through passive income, and he can help you do the same. www.impactequity.net.
I love it. So now you are the unique person where 9 times out of 10, when I talk to passive investors, they started actively, but you decided to start passively. I'm curious why you chose that route early on versus trying the active route that I hear so many people do.
Yeah, well, the answer is not great. The truth is, it was out of fear. I was too worried that, you know, I knew that the majority of my income was coming in from me being a business owner. Okay. Yeah. Now, me being a business owner, and anybody that's a business owner out there, you know that you already take a great risk, you know, because there's nothing guaranteed in business, right? It's not like you're putting your money into a CD and you're guaranteed to get something and it's FDIC secured. Business is one of those things that, you know, you could be good and you could be bad, and majority of businesses fail. So from a investment standpoint, I was already taking a lot of risk there. Right. And then did I have stocks? Yes. And did I have certain things that were conservative? Yes. Did I want to play with certain areas? Yes. But I didn't want to sit there and start buying real estate because I just didn't understand it enough myself.
That makes sense.
To understand, yeah. Well, if I buy this and I'm putting this much money in, and if I buy a house and if I have to try to find renters, there's any issues, do I have the bandwidth for it? And I knew I did not have the bandwidth, but I still knew I wanted to participate. So really, how do I participate with that and not have the bandwidth? And my answer was syndications, learn as much as you can, and one day let me try to be more active in it.
I love it.
And who doesn't passive cash flow? Who doesn't like differentiating your income passively coming in a stock portfolio? That's great. The stock goes up and down, but are you feeling it? Are you able to write a check and, you know, pay your bills with it? No, but we know in passive investments that money, that preferred interest rate actually goes into your checking account and you're actually able to use it right away.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. So yeah, I think that was really smart. It's interesting. I ended up, as part of my W-2 job, I was interviewing entrepreneurs for 15 plus years. And what I generally found with entrepreneurs is they found it was better to take their dollars and invest back into their business versus investing in other avenues. So I'm curious, what kind of drove that decision versus, you know, you've got $100,000, whether I put it in my business or I put it into somebody else's deal. Was it truly just a diversification and fear play, or was something else kind of driving that?
Oh, I was putting money back into my company. I was funding life insurance policies that were like almost like your own bank account. I was doing a diversification of a lot of different things, you know, so I had money going in different areas, but one of them, I still wanted to do real estate. This was just something that was in me that I want to do real estate. I have to figure out how, you know, and this was my first step in it and said, okay, well, this is my let me tiptoe into it. This was the way to tiptoe into it. And you're right. A lot of business owners say to themselves, hey, my greater return is going to be if I put my money into my own business. But the only issue is you're not differentiating your income. You're also putting all your eggs in one basket. And I said, I'm already putting a lot into my business. So let me put it into other things.
Yeah, I hear that story all the time. And that was always my thought. Like, you're already betting pretty much all of your savings, all of your income, all of your livelihood on one business. Doesn't it make sense to diversify? So it's interesting to hear that you went down that path. Now, you mentioned something. Go ahead.
And what your viewers or listeners are going to hear soon, I had sold my business, but I'm still getting my passive income coming in right now because I still had that diversification, which we'll go into all that later. So it did work out.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's dig into it then. So you get the idea that you want to start passive investing. Yeah. 15 years ago, very different world. Everything at the time, I think, was pretty much 506B or what is now 506B. So it's just friends and family. These are not advertised deals. So how did you start finding those deals early on? It was very different back then.
Well, the first deal that I actually did was not a fund. It was more of a company that did management, meaning you buy the actual property and they will do the management. They will give you guarantees that we will find you a renter guaranteed. If we don't have a renter within 1 month, we'll pay your mortgage for you. So that was my first thing, and that was in Philadelphia. And I was like, okay, well, you know, that sounds like a good deal. Let me do that. I did it. A year or so went by. Everything seemed good. I said, let me do another one. And then I just kept scaling up, and I kept taking the money and reinvesting it into it. And then at the same time, I'm like, this is actually really nice for me to be able to participate. In those cases, I actually own the property, but somebody guaranteed all those things. Did they take a cut of management fee? Yeah, but did I share? Sure. No, because I was making the lot. I was still making, you know, more money from it. And I'm the one who held the title. So I started exploring and listening to more podcasts on syndications. And I just started seeing all these things that I wasn't exposed to. And I don't know if it's Apple or the way it is, but once you subscribe onto one, all of a sudden you're getting all these different things.
Yeah.
You're like, whoa, I never even knew about it. So, and it was still very early on where the podcast would mention terms that I'd never heard of. So I would quickly pause it, write it down, then have to Google it later. They'll mention things like IRR. And I was like, what is that? Then I have to go cap rate. What is that? And I have to go research it and look it up. And I would have to research it and look it up multiple times so it sinks in my head because it's not where I come from. I come from healthcare. So, it again and again and again. And then it becomes like normal lingo. And now you just use the lingo and other people don't get it. And you're like, oh, wait. I gotta explain it a little bit better.
I love it. Yeah. It sounds like was that a turnkey model is what it was? The turnkey short-term
rentals?
That one was.
And then what I noticed is, you know, for my personal business, I would need tax mitigation plays, right? So then I started learning about, oh, well, it's not just about, you know, the return that you're getting, because if you can actually save on taxes, your returns are huge then. You know, people don't realize that depending on what tax bracket if you're able to take that tax bracket and go way down, you just made a lot more money. Absolutely. So there's a lot of tax play. So for certain things, I would actually use tax mitigation stuff. You know, that's why my portfolio would have some things like ATM or natural gas or other things, because there's, you know, natural tax incentives that are built into some of these things.
I love it. I love it. So as you're growing your business, you're taking a portion of your income, whether it be for return metrics or for tax strategy, and you're kind of just siphoning dollars over into your passive investments, and that starts to grow over time. So at some point, then you make a decision that you're going to exit the business and move into something different. So what did that period of time in that season look like?
The whole idea is being a business owner, you're looking at your landscape, right? And I was trained to run my business by looking at statistics. You're always looking at your stats, you know, and when you see trends starting to happen, you're like, wait a second, something's got to change here. Something's got to give. So my opportunity was, do I partner with a strategic company, which is a larger physical therapy company, or do I partner with a private equity company that's coming into this space that wants to be in this space? You know, either way, you're taking some chips off the table, and then you're also going to stay there and you're going to help it grow. I chose the private equity model, and this was a brand new private equity company that was getting started. I was one of the founding members. We took it from my practices in New Jersey, which was about 4 practices, and then we built it over to about 100 across the country in about 15 different states, you know, with me. And there was a big team that was there that was supporting everything. But, you know, that started the process of us really, and it took a couple of years to do, but a couple of years as opposed to 20 years, you know, when you have private equity money that's backing you, and they're just backing very similar, if you think about it. I was buying into syndications because I was putting my money into operators that knew what they were doing, right? Yeah. Here comes private equity backing me and the organization because we knew what we were doing on the physical therapy end.
Interesting.
Same idea, really. You know, just putting fuel on the fire and just letting the people who know how to do it, do it.
Yeah. And that's what we did. You were the operator that they invested in. And then was there a big buyout at one point, or was it just a simple equity play, or what did that look like?
Well, the initial, we call first bite of the apple happened in 2017, where the private equity comes in and they take, you know, a certain percentage of your company, and once you give up a certain percentage of your company, you take some chips off the table, and then you go to work trying to build out the whole company with them. Not just me, there's a lot of other people that are doing it with you. You know, you have a C-suite, you have other partners that are going in, and then you get big enough, and generally what happens, people start noticing. And then you have other private equity companies that are larger that come in and say, well, we want to buy the whole thing over. And that's what happened in 2021. And that's when I exited, right around that time.
Okay. So 21, you have the big exit, you have a huge cash infusion yourself, and then you've got to put, I would imagine, you had to put those dollars into play, into action.
Yeah.
And I'm guessing a large portion of that was real estate. Is that where you placed most of that capital?
By that time, I'd been doing real estate plays and syndications for long enough, and I kind of understood certain things that I liked and what I didn't like. And I decided that I wanted an industrial flex property. It was a triple net property. From my vantage point, it was very simple. You know, it wasn't a lot of moving parts. Multifamily, you have tenants that live there, right? You know, there's squatters' rights. There's different things. In an industrial flex property, you have a tenant. The tenant doesn't pay it, it's easier to move out than that. Yeah. And then with triple net, for those viewers that already know this, you know, triple net means that the tenant is paying majority of everything. You're really not involved day to day, you know. And I would tell you, if in a year I spent 5 hours a year on this, 5 to 10 hours a year, that would be a lot.
Unbelievable. Okay. So it truly was a place for you to park cash. Very, very passive and very little activity that you would have to put into it. I'm curious, I hear people that leverage different tax strategies when they have large exits. Did you use any interesting tax strategies to avoid
In 2017, I did. I had a financial advisor that had recommended something that now became a little bit, I don't want to call it risky, but noticeable. And it was land easements. You know, at the time, you know, wealthy people were doing land easements. I believe right now they're still doing them, but it became under scrutiny with the IRS. But I didn't have any issues with it. But in 2017, I did a land easement to help mitigate some taxes that I knew that I was getting.
Got it. And so I'm trying to think of any other strategies. Yeah, people use DSTs or Delaware statutory trusts when there's big exits as well, which it sounds to me that it works very similar to like a 1031, but it doesn't have the time constraints on it that you might have, and it doesn't have the like kind requirements that come with 1031. So was curious.
In 2017, I did not even have the wherewithal to understand what a DST was. You know, I did not have the exposure to the circles that I have now, you know.
Sure.
And to all the information that we have now. So 2017 was just like trying to figure out like what was going on. So you know, what I knew in 2007 and 21 was very different, and what I started doing later, you know, on a yearly basis for taxes and things like that was very different than what I started off doing.
Got it. Okay, very good. So, and of course, we're not tax professionals, so check with your CPAs. But
exactly.
Yeah. So, very interesting. So now you've come to a point, and you've become very skilled over the years at vetting deals and vetting operators, and you have started to share that expertise with your network as well, where you can now start bringing bigger checks to these operators and demanding more returns. But I'd love to dig in, if we can, just into that vetting process, the due diligence process that you go through, or maybe some of the stub toes that you had over the years through that learning process.
Yeah, so I had definitely learned out of necessity, because I actually got hurt from an investment that went bad. So, you know, in my early days, I had put some money into an investment and I did not know any better. I did as much due diligence as I could with the limited knowledge that I had. Turned out later, it became a Ponzi scheme. No idea. 2,000 investors nationwide lost money in it. They're still trying to collect, you know. So what did I learn from that process? You know, I actually had to sit back and sit and figure this out, going, where did I go wrong? What could I have done? And there is somebody who actually works with centimillionaires and billionaires, and they gave me their checklist. They gave me their due diligence checklist. So I have to be honest. His name was Richard C. Wilson. And he has the family office club, and he actually shared with me, he's like, hey, this is the due diligence checklist that we use. It's a 100-point checklist. Not all 100 items applies to every single business that you're doing due diligence on, but there's a lot of items on there. So you really have to dig in. You have to look at this. So now I utilize that whenever a syndicator comes and approaches me. So fast forward a little bit. I have a company now. After I exited my last company, some syndicators had approached me saying, hey, Amit, you've been helping us raise constantly with you bringing your friends to the table. Would you want to help us? We have some deals that we want to close up. You know us already. You know, you've worked with us. Would you want to come on and just kind of help us close these investments up? So I said, okay, I started another company, and that company, AG Management Consulting, really just helped those companies from an outsourced investor relations standpoint. You know, we do the nurturing, we talk to investors, we help them to get the capital sources that they needed to help close their investments through the things that I was automatically doing before. And the thing is, before I can take anybody on as a client, I have to vet them out fully. The reason why is I'm representing them, but I have my own book of business, which is my family and friends that I share the investments too, because if I do a good vetting process and I feel like this is a good investment, it usually means I'm willing to invest there too. So then I would be able to give my own family and friends saying, hey, this is a good investment for X, Y, and Z reasons. You should invest here. And I wouldn't feel comfortable doing that unless I've actually done that whole vetting process, because who wants to share that with family and friends? Like I said, it came out of necessity, but I got burned. So now I know that, you know, this is the process that I have to go through, you know. A little stricter.
I'm curious on the one that you got burned on, was it, had you brought any investors to that, or had you shared that with your friends and family, or?
Oh yeah, I definitely had to share that with friends and family, you know, because I had been investing there for years and years and years and got positive returns. So you know, once you've had like a good track record, you're like, oh, let me share this with people, because they've been doing so good with me. And then they change their model internally. And that's that's the thing that I realized afterwards, that my due diligence, you know, I didn't, you know, I did it initially with them, but I didn't have the 100-point checklist, right? But then once they changed the model, it should have been done again.
Got it. So maybe there's some cadence that if you have an operator that you work with, that there should be an ongoing due diligence process to catch some of those business model changes.
And obviously, if they change their business model, then you got to analyze their new business model from scratch.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, I think that's really good advice, because I have a number of folks that I've been investing with for years and years now, and as market changes and the economy changes, business models change, and likely their strategies change as well, because they have to ever evolve. So I'm curious, what type of a business change or evolution occurred there that it went from something that looked like a very good investment to ultimately a Ponzi scheme, like robbing Peter to pay Paul, essentially, right?
Well, I think everybody's still trying to figure that out. Nobody knows exactly how it went down and what exactly changed. They changed the fund model. They hired somebody else that became in charge of a fund that they didn't have before. They trusted somebody else a lot more. Then as they took more money in, they used that money to pay investors. And then when they internally had some issues, it looked like they weren't buying more buildings. So the revenue kind of cycle was slowing down, but they were still raising. So the raising was paying for the pref that they were paying out. But something to that degree. I don't know exact nuances, because nobody knows, because, I think people scatter everywhere. So it's like, figure everything out later. Oh, the government's involved, and then it gets really messy. And then the information just, you don't know the right sources, what's exactly true, what's not, and what are people just talking about. So
Love it. Yeah. So that's the thing that every investor fears is the Ponzi scheme that comes up. So,
I will tell you though, Randy, but when you're diversified, it doesn't hurt as bad.
And you have that's where I was going to go. So let's talk about that. Like, what does your diversification strategy look like? Not only for your own portfolio, but for the portfolio that you're helping others build as well.
You know, it's funny that you asked that question, because it changes over time. It has definitely changed over the last 10 years. Like, what I thought I was doing at one stage, keeps evolving, keeps changing. There was a great book that I just finished reading by Tony Robbins, of all people. It's called The Holy Grail of Investing. And he goes into alternative assets, and he goes into Ray Dalio's approach, which, if any of your listeners know about Ray Dalio's approach, is, he was the manager and owner of Bridgewater Funds, and his philosophy in diversification was that you have 8 to 10 uncorrelated portfolios. So each portfolio has no correlation with the other portfolio. The reason being that if something happens in one sector, it doesn't affect the other sectors. One is, let's say, private lending, another one is real estate, another one is technology. Unless you're doing technology real estate, then of course there's a correlation, but the idea is to be diversified. Now, do I have that exactly? No, but we're always striving to be better than we were yesterday. That's basically the goal. So my diversification was always based on what was going on in my life at the time. Like, when I had my company, I was constantly thinking, how do I decrease my taxes? What am I investing in to decrease my taxes? Once I had the capital event, I said, okay, I'm going to put it in this industrial flex property, but I also need to do a cost segregation to try to, to mitigate the taxes that I'd be responsible for. So it's always hand in hand with tax mitigation as well as, capital appreciation.
Yeah. So it's a constant balancing.
Yes.
And I heard somebody recently say balance is a verb. So it's something that's ever changing. It's not ever static in any way. So, and it's kind of interesting too. It kind of ties to, like, when I was in the W-2, I wanted to diversify into real estate. I wanted to get away from the stock market, because I had a very large portion of my net worth tied up in my 401ks and my stock holdings, mutual funds, things like that. So now that I'm very heavily invested in real estate, I'm starting to look at other avenues as well, because real estate has highs and lows as well. And even in addition to that, I'm really spending a lot of time looking at the cash flow versus the equity growth play in that piece as well, because I'm at a different season in my earnings than others. So I'm curious, when you're looking at investments, do you consider yourself a cash flow investor or an equity investor or a combination, or like, how do you decide or dictate
those types of decisions? Well, I'll tell you that high net worth doesn't pay the bills. Cash flow pays the bills.
Absolutely.
So there's a reason why we always say cash flow is king. Everybody likes the idea of, I have a high net worth, but you're not writing a check with your high net worth. So you can't be all one and not the other. You can't be all cash flow and not the other side of it. So it has to be an equal balance. And if you're looking at your overall portfolio, you kind of want some that are giving you cash flow now and some that are you're planting the seed for a better future later, and some that they're investments that you're purely doing to offset certain taxes. And like I said, you're doing it because if you can offset taxes, you know, that's income right there. That's absolutely income that you're already making that you don't have to give up is the point.
If you can save 37%, that's the best investment you've ever made, right?
Exactly. Exactly. Absolutely. So it's a combination of all. And it's always a balance because some of those investments mature, right? Then all of a sudden they give you your money back and now you're like, oh, I wasn't aware that that was coming back this fast. Now I got another tax issue. So it's always rebalancing it. It's always rebalancing, refiguring out what's the best play in that. And that's how kind of what happened when I invested in the Amazon stores and everything like that. I got back money from a self-storage investment that I didn't expect to get back for 5 to 7 years, but it happened in 18 months because somebody offered them $450 million and they didn't want to say no to it. So that happened 18 months after I invested. And I was like, oh, I wasn't ready for this money. What am I going to do with it? So,
good problem to have, I guess, right? If you had one of those a year, that'd be a good situation. So now do you have like kind of a set percentage, like a set dollar amount that you like to use for each investment? I hear some people say, you know, not to exceed 3 to 5% per operator or per deal that they work with. Do you have any strategies that you use there? Or?
No, honestly, during that whole vetting process, I look at how much it is. But, you know, for a new syndicator that I don't know as well, I'll take a look at the minimums and I'll probably start there just as a peace of mind. Because at the end of the day, you know, for all your investors, you need to be able to sleep at night. Once you've seen certain investments go bad, you're like, you know what, let me be more cautious and let me put in from the beginning a little bit. And let's see how it goes. If they're a really good operator, they communicate well, they're not saying that they're going to perform like these great, you know, unrealistic numbers, but they're steady and they're communicative. You're like, okay, I feel better about this. And then you put more in.
Awesome. Good stuff. I love to hear you say that because that's my same strategy as well. I will actually even ask if I can do half of the minimum. I'm surprised to hear quite often that operators will take half of what their minimum is. So that makes me feel good that you're kind of doing the same thing. You test the waters with a little bit, they build your trust and confidence, then you come back with a bigger check thereafter. So great idea. Yeah. Now, I should have dug into this a little bit more, but when we were talking about the due diligence process and this 100-point checklist, were there maybe a couple of different due diligence things that really jumped out when you reviewed that list that would be really good lessons for our listeners to hear? Or were they just much more detailed questions about
some of them are topic, super so. Detailed questions. Some of them are super detailed that it makes the syndicators cringe when they would hear it. So, because it's not an easy answer that they can spit off. But some of them are like, you know, they do a background search on the actual syndicator to make sure they have no criminal record or criminal activities in the past. You know, most people, but that's not easy to get done either, you know, and some syndicators won't feel comfortable doing it. But so then you have to be okay with walking away or saying, no, you know, this isn't, you know, for me. But if a syndicator or sponsor, you know, from your investor standpoint, they have to be a good steward of your money. So how do you know if they're a good steward of your money if you don't know what they've done in the past, right? If they've done some criminal activity in the past, you're like, well, why would I invest with them? But if you don't know that, then
Yeah, that's a good question. We started doing that with ours, but there's different levels of background checks you can do as well. You can go and spend your $19.99 to get a quick background check, but how much is that going to really show you? So I think it's important for investors to work with folks like yourself who have longstanding relationships that have been watching those operators for years and years. Because, you know, something I share quite often is I think anybody can show up for an investor webinar or a podcast or something like that, but people truly show themselves if you're able to watch them for, you know, for months and years and decades. Eventually you get to know those people very well and you know how they perform when things get tough, because things are going to get tough in this space at some point. It's not all rainbows and unicorns, unfortunately. So, what are you guys working on today? Do you have any new projects you're working on? Anything you're excited about at the moment?
Well, actually, from us meeting in Arizona, a lot of syndicators actually reached out to us and are having conversations about what they're doing. And I will tell you, we say no to syndicators all the time. You know, the truth is, if we ourselves wouldn't want to invest in what they're offering, we don't take them on. Not only that, but some people have unrealistic expectations, so we don't want to take them on. You know, we're just looking for the right type of syndicator who's looking for a long, nurturing relationship, and that isn't just looking for, hey, I need money in 2 months or something like that. That's not the kind of relationship that we want, you know, and that's not what we want to represent either. So, you know, we're having a lot of different discussions with people who are looking for long-term benefits and long-term relationships, especially with our business model, the way it is. Well, we're the outsource investor relations for them. So, you know, that's what's keeping us busy on that front. AG Management Consulting is also doing a lot of things in healthcare services and private equity healthcare things. So, you know, my background being in healthcare, so.
That's your expertise. That's your wheelhouse for sure. Yeah.
It's fun having these opportunities. Yeah.
Very cool. Well, we're at about the half hour mark, and I want to be respectful of everybody's time, but I do have a few questions that I'd like to ask everybody if you still have a couple of minutes.
Sure.
All right. Well, you mentioned one book, The Holy Grail of Investing by Tony Robbins, but are there any other books or resources that you would suggest or advise to the new or newer passive investor?
So my answer on this frequently changes depending on what I'm reading. And
sure.
I fall in love with a new book every time. And I'm like, oh, this is the best book. Like right now, I just finished the one that I said by Tony Robbins. And I loved it because it's apropos for what's going on right now with alternative investing and just what we what you and I would talk about all the time. And we look at this stuff, and for people who are not used to it, they should absolutely read it because they're going to learn about things that they've never learned about. You know,
love it. Okay.
Called The Holy Grail of Investing by Tony Robbins. It just came out. And his book before that was called, I think, Money Master the Game, which is another good book by him. You know,
very, very thick books. I read the first one. I haven't yet picked this one up yet, but
audio. Yeah. You can do it on Spotify, I think. So yes, if you're driving a lot, you're on the treadmill, it's a good way to,
I love it.
Way to get through some of these things, and then just pause it and write down the terms that you're not familiar with.
I love it.
Podcast.
Yeah, you know, I've been spending a lot more time watching like economics and watching the economy and folks that are very good interpreters of what's going on in the economy. I'm curious, do you have any channels or books or people that you follow in that space specifically?
Not consistently. I just feel like somebody, and to be honest with you, I hate to sound jaded, I always feel like there's an angle somewhere and I just can't tell a good objective source that's, you know, looking at it objectively as opposed to there's something to gain.
Absolutely. Always look at who's writing their checks to them. You'll probably find the motivation behind it. Okay, very good. Kind of a fun one here. Have you recently or are you planning on checking a bucket list item off your list in the coming year or so?
My 50th birthday will be coming up in about a year. I'm going to go to Cambodia and Vietnam, which is an area of the world I have absolutely never been to. I'm looking forward to that.
Fantastic. Cambodia and Vietnam. Fantastic. My wife and I, I've got the goal of seeing all 7 continents. And, we're only about halfway through that, but listening to these, Cambodia and Vietnam, I'd never even thought of going there. I hear it's beautiful though. I'm sure it'll be a fantastic.
Me neither. It was just an area of the whole world that I've never been to. So I said, why not do something different?
What's your favorite place you've been to this point? If you had to pick one.
Favorite place. Oh man. I love going to Europe, but I love spending, I spent a month in Hawaii and that was phenomenal. Spent 2 weeks in Maui, 1 week in Kona, 1 week in Honolulu. I think it was because of the time that I was there, allowed me to really, really get into it. So it was great.
I love it. Very good. All right. And then one final question. If you had 100,000 today that you needed to invest within the next, 5 to 7 days, where would you place that capital if you couldn't put it in one of your own deals?
So, can't put it into one of my own deals. That's a tough one.
And actually, you're kind of unique. You can put it into one of your deals
because of what I've learned, I really like the industrial flex or triple net properties. And because my networks and started for me doing as an LP have gotten to a point where I know larger players, I would venture into a partnership with some of these these other players that I know. We would pool our money and get another triple net property.
Love it. Very easy, very passive, and 5 to 10 hours a year on that type of play. That sounds very, very attractive.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, Amit, it's been a pleasure having you on the podcast. I think you brought a lot of value to the audience. Is there a place where folks could find you if they wanted to connect with you or learn more about what you're doing?
Absolutely. If anybody's interested in putting themselves on my list, they can email me at Amit, A-M-I-T, period, Gaglani, G-A-G-L-A-N-I, A-G-M-G-M-T. inc.com. That's a lot. Hopefully you have some show notes that people can
Yeah. Click on the link in the show notes and you'll email it directly. Please. So, well, very good. Well, thanks so much again for being on the show. It was definitely a pleasure.
All righty.
All right. And to the audience, as always, thank you so much for joining us today. We continue to urge you to continue that education process, but more importantly than that, make the decision to invest in your first passive deal. Both Amit and I are very convinced that once you do, you'll be so happy that you did and wish you had started much earlier. But thanks again for joining today. Be sure to join us again next Thursday for another great episode. Thank you.
Well, there you have it, ladies and gentlemen, another episode of The Gentle Art of Crushing It. It was an amazing episode. We know we sure learned a lot, and we hope you did as well. We want to take a second and thank you so much for viewing or listening to this episode. And please just know that we only ask for one favor, and that is to make this life magnificent. Thank you, and have a wonderful day.